This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
One word, three syllables, synonym for economic downturn. How you feeling about whether a recession is a-coming? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 23rd day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin on this Tuesday with a stipulation and a caveat. The stipulation is that economic predictions can bring great peril to the one doing the predicting. There are a whole lot of unknown unknowns out there to get all Rumsfeldian on you here. The caveat, though, is that if you read enough tea leaves for long enough, you can get a pretty good sense of where things might be heading. Might being the operational phrase, which gets us, at long last, to the point. There has been in this economy much talk in the last 6 months, maybe a year-ish, of recession, sooner rather than later, too. The stock market, you remember, had a case of the willies, retail sales were slipping, trade wars and Brexit, you know the drill. Well, things might be changing. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino took the pulse of the economic outlook today to see whether there might be reason for optimism.
The economists I talked to weren't exactly excited about the state of the economy when I asked them how it's going.
Okay, not too bad.
We're not heading into the abyss.
That's not fantastic, but it's very far from a recession.
That's an improvement, right? Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics, who we heard first, says the economy is looking better. Job numbers are strong, consumer spending is bounced back, and wages are rising.
It looked a lot more fragile at the start of the year than it does today. So I do think imminent recession risks have faded.
So no imminent risks. It's helped that China's economy is also doing better than expected, despite the disruption of the trade war, says Cornell economist Eshwar Prasad, speaking here about China.
The economy is not quite firing on all cylinders, but at least the slowdown seems to have been averted to some extent.
But there's still a lot of uncertainty elsewhere in the world, says Michael Pierce with Capital Economics, you know, the abyss guy.
We've still got some pretty strong headwinds to the economy this year.
He points to economic vulnerabilities like Brexit and the potential for yet another government shutdown over budget clashes. Pierce expects economic growth to continue to weaken, certainly below the level we saw after last year's tax cuts. But Dean Baker with the Center for Economic and Policy Research says that's not such a bad place to be.
And that's the growth rate we had 2012 to 2017.
So not great, not abyss. For now, somewhere in between. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
For now. Take that, right? Spring home buying seems to be off to a robust start, new homes at least. The Census Bureau says sales of those new homes rose 4.5% February to March, the third straight month of gains, thanks in part to lower interest rates and lower prices. Meanwhile, the way people buy and sell homes in this economy is changing. There is news today that the biggest real estate chain in the country, Keller Williams, is getting into something called the instant buyer business, making cash offers to home sellers up front before even listing the properties. That'll bring Keller Williams' 180,000 or so agents into competition with tech companies like Zillow and Opendoor and OfferPad, who are doing something similar. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains why a brick-and-mortar realtor is getting into business that was pioneered digitally.
Let's say you want to sell your house. You could go the traditional route, fix it up, stage it, and endure looky-loos traipsing through your door until you get a good offer. Or you could request an instant offer from a growing number of companies known as iBuyers and sell within a few days.
There's a surprising number of people who value the convenience and simplicity.
Galen Ziegler is director of operations at Keller Offers.
And they will give up portions of their equity in a home in order to have that convenience.
Keller Williams will launch the service in Dallas-Fort Worth next month and expand to 6 to 8 cities by the end of the year. The reason, Ziegler says, is pretty straightforward.
We decided that we needed to.
Billions of dollars are pouring into the iBuyer business from Zillow and Redfin and startups like Opendoor and OfferPad. Analyst Brad Erickson with Needham & Company says this is a defensive move for the brokerage.
Keller Williams' objective is to broker home sales. And so if they see that their competitors are out providing liquidity and that may be pulling business elsewhere from their brokerage business, then of course that's why they have to get involved.
But how many people will accept a likely lower offer rather than try their chances on the market, especially in a hot market? Real estate tech strategist Mike Delpredi says last year there were only about 25,000 transactions.
And that's 0.2% market share. But that's national, and none of the iBuyers are national yet.
But there's room to grow. In Phoenix, where iBuyers have been operating for several years, they capture about 6% of sales. And Delpredi says 20 to 30% of serious sellers in Phoenix request an instant offer before bringing their homes to market.
Why wouldn't you? There's no risk. But just, you know, be warned that, once you do that, and you're in somebody's system, like, yeah, you're a lead. And they know you're interested in selling your house. So there's going to be real estate agents knocking at your door to try to get your business to help you sell your home.
And those leads may be more profitable for brokers than flipping homes. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
With the standard caveat here, the stock market is not the economy. The economy is not the stock market. Lather, rinse, repeat. Traders do seem to be feeling that economic not pessimism Megan was telling us about. Record highs on the S&P and the NASDAQ. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the caveat that the government of the United States is not and should not be run like a business, there is a parallel to corporate life that the Trump administration is highlighting. There is a well-documented tendency on the president's part toward putting acting or temporary occupants into some of the most senior jobs in Washington. Less well-documented, though, the thriving temp culture at the top of the corporate ladder. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
At last count, there were acting heads at the Defense Department, Homeland Security, the Small Business Administration, and the Office of Management and Budget. There may be more by the time I finish this story. And that's just how President Trump likes it, as he told CBS's Face the Nation in February.
I like acting because I can move so quickly. Mm-hmm. It gives me more flexibility.
The kind of flexibility that's increasingly on display in the private sector, too.
The board has appointed Bob Swan as interim CEO.
That happened at Intel last June. And last month, the hammer dropped at Wells Fargo.
The firm's general counsel, C. Allen Parker, will become interim CEO and president.
J. Crew, Comscore, and Herbalife have also brought on interim CEOs this year.
This has hit the C-suite.
Robert Jordan heads a placement agency for interim execs. Jordan, a former interim himself, started the company 11 years ago when he noticed that demand was soaring for people willing to parachute in at a moment's notice to stabilize a company in crisis or fill an empty seat at the top when there's no obvious successor.
From 2008 to roughly 2014, the use of the phrase interim on LinkedIn rose tenfold.
That was, by the way, during the financial crisis, an especially tumultuous period for corporate America. Today, Jordan's agency represents more than 300 interim execs. Most are former chief executives or chief financial officers.
They're temps. They're super temps.
Jordan says they typically earn what a permanent CEO makes in salary, sometimes more, but no bonuses, no stock options. Davia Temin coaches interim executives. She says it's a tough job.
You've got the title, almost. You've got the responsibility, almost. But when it comes to long-term strategy and planning and action and vision and mission, you don't have that nod.
Temin says most interim CEOs are brought into a company in some sort of crisis to calm things down and give valuable workers a reason to stick around.
If that interim CEO is doing a good job, he or she is making people feel that they have gotten a gift, somebody who is mentoring them in the extreme.
That takes a certain kind of somebody, a person who can put their ego to the side and gain people's trust. Howard Broad Brownstein has been an exec gig worker for more than 25 years. He says when he starts an interim job,
I spend long hours at the company, and I hope people come up to me. And if they don't, I go over to them and just say, how's it going? Or show me what you're doing.
Brownstein says trust is key if you want to understand what's going on. He says he was brought in once to help a drugstore supplier, which was mysteriously losing money. No one wanted to talk about why. So he turned to another temp.
She was a deputy assistant, temporary bookkeeper or something, sitting in some sub-basement office with no windows. And I asked her if she knew anything about this. And she said, oh, I wondered when someone would ask me.
Most interim execs are in and out of a company in a year. If you're looking for something more permanent, it looks great on a resume and may help level the playing field. Robert Jordan says 12% of the interim leaders he represents are women, and one of them just landed the top job at a big state agency. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We're still just about a third or so of the way through the year, but already big retailers have announced more store closings than they did in all of 2018. That is felt perhaps nowhere as much as it's felt in shopping malls, which have already been having a tough time, as we've been telling you. So we have called up one of our regulars, Alana Furco. She is the manager of the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. Last time we talked to her, in case you don't remember, she was getting a call center and the 350 jobs that go with that call center into what had been a JCPenney store. Here you go. Hey, Alana, it's Kai. How are you?
Happy spring, Kai. It's nice to hear from you today.
Happy spring to you, too. How's the weather in Butte today?
Today is beautiful. Birds singing, beautiful blue sky, no wind. It is gorgeous.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So, look, we wanted to check in on the call center. I guess we had you on, three, four, 5 months ago. You were filling that space in the mall with the call center. How's it going?
It is going great. They are upgrading the interior. They'll be receiving furniture in the next couple of weeks. They're going to use one of our empty spaces as a temporary training center so that they can get people into the call center quicker once everybody's ready to move in.
Where is everybody going to come from? Do you have enough people in Butte to fill all the jobs that this place is going to bring?
You know, we do, and it'll be Butte and the surrounding areas, because honestly, once you're in the car around here, it's a nice drive to get wherever you're going.
Yeah,
so
that's my memory of Montana. What else is going on space-wise in the mall? I mean, you had a couple of big empty spots, right?
I do have a 70,000-square-foot former department store space and a smaller 20,000-square-foot space. But yes, you know, since the call center announced, we've had a little bit of interest. I've shown the big spaces a couple of times, but also shown some of the smaller spaces as well.
How does it work? Do you just like put ads in the local paper? How do you advertise 70,000 square feet of space in a mall?
We actually have a leasing agent who's with a bigger real estate company.
Got it.
So, he puts the inventory out there, and anybody looking to expand into this market, hopefully we'll set up for a site visit and we'll just wow them and they'll just move in as soon as possible.
Let me ask you something about life outside the Butte Plaza Mall. When you walk, down to the bank or to the parking lot for your car, what's the vibe? Are there help wanted signs? Are there indications that the economy might be turning a corner and growing? What's the feeling in Butte?
Well, Butte is a little different. Butte has never really trended nationally until these past 5 years, we are starting to follow national trends. Low unemployment in this area.
Right.
You know, lots of good things are happening. There's some really good housing going up. Hmm. So that is going to help entice more people to come into the community. Mm-hmm. Lots of good people are doing good things to make it better.
So we'll call you before this, obviously, but in a year when we talk, what's it going to be like in Butte? What's your guess?
Definitely the call center is going to have a good year under their belt. I'm going to have more spaces filled with good things to offer to the community. Things are going to be better, Kai.
Alana Furco, she runs the Butte Plaza Mall out there in Butte, Montana. Alana, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You take care, sir. Thanks for calling.
Coming up.
And we figured someday that we could get this thing really going if we got something nobody else has and help the community.
One little business and its fight for more regulation. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 145 points today, 0.5%, 26,656. The NASDAQ up 105 points, 1.3%, 8,120. The S&P 500 added 25 points, 0.8%, 29.33. As I said, for the NASDAQ and the S&P, record highs. Procter & Gamble posted strong sales growth in its quarterly earnings call this morning. P&G, of course, owns a lot of familiar household brands, Comet Cleanser, Gillette, Crest, the toothpaste. The company did raise prices last year. It also says it sees strong growth in U.S. and China, and its sales there. Hello, Megan McCarty-Carino's spot. However, this being capitalism, Procter & Gamble shaved off 2.6% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Amy Scott was talking about instant home sales up at the top of the program. We are going to do a story now that will take you back to the tippy top of the real estate bubble, say 2006 or so, courtesy of the phrase house flipping. People, as you remember, buying a place, fixing it up, and then selling it quick for a tiny little profit. There's some new data out from the analytics firm CoreLogic that shows the percentage of homes flipped in the fourth quarter of 2018 hit almost the same level as back in the aforementioned 2006, which, although not the causal factor, helped get us on the slippery slope to the financial crisis and the Great Recession, as I am sure you recall. Laura Cosisto wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal the other day, so we called her up. Laura, it's good to have you on.
Thank you.
So, I mean, why is the big question here, right? What is going on that people are flipping houses now?
Well, we are definitely seeing some echoes of the last housing boom, which makes sense because we're getting pretty far into the housing cycle. And this is kind of when funny stuff starts to happen. And so we're seeing house flipping back up to 2006 levels, basically to the same level as the last boom.
However, you say it's not as much of a concern now, and which gets me to the same question. Why?
Yeah, so house flipping has changed. We kind of all remember the stories of house flipping more than a decade ago when it was, you know, cocktail waitresses and cab drivers, and they were lining up. You know, people were sleeping outside these new developments and buying homes, and then hoping that the prices would shoot up yet more and they could sell them. It looks really different this time. We're talking about professionals, people who do this for their living, and they're buying much older homes, you know, homes that are on average 4 decades old, and putting real work into them. And so kind of actually adding some value. And the idea is that hopefully buffers them a little bit if prices start to fall again.
Yeah, but on that buffer point, I mean, I can hang on to my house because it's my house and I need to live there. Can a flipper, no matter how professional he or she may be, can they weather a downturn?
Yeah, I would not be too cavalier. I mean, I think they are giving themselves a little more wiggle room because I think they're buying houses at a better, lower price. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's always going to be demand for a beautiful, new, fixed-up home.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, that is absolutely the problem. A lot of them are getting financing where they have to sell within a year or two. And if it were me, I don't know if I would buy a house right now if I had to sell it in a couple of years.
Right. As we know, housing is tight in this country right now. So what is this new, I guess, rash of flipping doing to, say, first-time home buyers and prices that are affordable and those things that actually make a sustainable housing market?
So I think one way you could argue is that they're coming in and they're competing, often buying in cash against millennials who are looking to buy their first home. But I would actually sort of argue the opposite way, which is that I'm renovating a home myself right now, and it's twice as expensive as we thought it would be, and that's terrifying when you're an ordinary person. And so I would argue that they're actually taking inventory that's not really usable for people, that needs a year of TLC, and they're making it something that someone can buy and move right in.
Scale of 1 to 10-ish, how concerned should people listening to this program be about home flipping being on the rise? Because as we all know, and as I said in the introduction, there are few words scarier to the memory of the financial crisis than house flipping.
Oh, it's a great question. Maybe I'm going to really hedge my bets and say
fair.
5.
Okay, all right. I'll take that.
Because I'm definitely worried whenever we see speculation. This feels very 2006 to me. I quote someone in my story who says that she's a professional flipper, and she now goes to look at a house, and there are 5 people lined up out the door who don't know what they're doing. We should definitely be worried about that. But I also am always really cognizant of not saying this looks exactly the same as the last time.
Yeah.
And so I think we're going to see some people get hurt, but probably not the wide-scale, massive destruction that we saw last time.
Laura Cosisto covers housing and real estate for The Wall Street Journal. Laura, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
We're in a deregulatory cycle in this economy right now. The Trump administration has made it a point to get rid of a lot of the rules and standards governing how businesses do business. But in the North Woods of Minnesota, there is a company bucking that trend and its own industry by fighting for a strict new environmental rule. Lampa Manufacturing makes a wood heater that was the first to pass a tough federal regulation that is scheduled to go into effect next year. And as Dan Crocker from Minnesota Public Radio reports, the company is banking on the EPA to keep that rule in place.
Inside a cramped 85-year-old converted dairy creamery in the tiny town of Tower, workers are welding together a wood-burning furnace, certified by the EPA as the cleanest one on the market. It's called the Kuma Vaporfire 100, and it was designed by this guy.
My name is Daryl Herbert Lampa. My dad and I built his company up from scratch.
Lampa is 70, a fast-talking, wood-burning evangelist. He says the company's roots actually go back to his grandfather, who built stoves for saunas for Finnish settlers during the Depression.
And everybody in that area, they wanted a Richard Lampa sauna stove because my grandpa was the head welder at the shipyards in Duluth when they were first welding down there.
Lampa's grandfather taught Lampa's father how to make stoves, who in turn taught him. Then, after a scare one winter when his chimney caught on fire, Lampa and his dad decided to try and design a wood furnace. It's like a wood stove, only big enough to heat an entire home. They reasoned if they could build one that burned super efficiently, they'd be able to eliminate creosote, the highly flammable residue that can build up inside chimneys.
And my dad was right. If you burn wood with no smoke, you get rid of the creosote and you more or less get rid of the pollution. And what's better than that?
In the late 70s, the Lampas began producing wood furnaces, in addition to sauna stoves. Their timing was perfect. After the oil embargo earlier that decade, Americans by the millions began heating with wood. John Ackerley, president of the nonprofit Alliance for Green Heat, says at first there were no environmental rules.
That has left the country with the legacy of these very basic smoky boxes. And we're still living with that legacy. The majority of wood stoves are old ones that are not regulated.
And the pollution they emit can cause serious health problems. In 1989, the EPA placed emission standards on smaller wood stoves, but it ignored wood boilers and furnaces until 2015. Next spring, those regulations are scheduled to get a lot stricter. New furnaces will have to emit 84% less particulate matter than they do now. So far, only 2 companies have met that standard, Lampa and a Missouri company called HYC. The industry overall has fought the new rules. They argue they're too strict and the deadline is too soon. John Crouch with the Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association, which represents many wood heater manufacturers, agrees there needs to be a uniform federal rule.
But it does need to be well thought out and attainable.
The Trump administration is considering whether to relax the standard and has proposed allowing retailers to sell less efficient furnaces for 2 more years. But several states, including Minnesota, want the new rules to go into effect. So does Lampa. He says he spent years and a lot of money perfecting the design on his furnace, which sells for $5,700, thousands of dollars more than some of his competitors.
And we figured someday that we could get this thing really going if we got something nobody else has and help the community.
Today, about 25,000 wood-burning furnaces are sold every year in the U.S. Lampa says gaining even a 10% share of the market would mean big growth for his company. To prepare, he plans to move into a new and bigger manufacturing facility next month. In Tower, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Fly on the Wall edition. Twitter announced quite nice. Thank you very much. Quarterly profits this morning, handily beating estimates and helping Twitter shares pick up 13% during the session. Arguably, though, that was not the big item on CEO Jack Dorsey's calendar. Dorsey met with President Trump at the White House today in the Oval Office, the president, of course, being a faithful user of Dorsey's product. The meeting has been confirmed by both the White House and Twitter. Twitter's readout of the meeting said it was about, and this is a quote, the health of the public conversation on Twitter. I'm just going to leave that there. All right, we're going. The Dow up 145 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 105, that's 1.3%. The NASDAQ added 25 points, 0.8%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platts, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Zitar Nieves is the executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.